Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
The Mean Team.
With guest co-hosts.
Wolfpack.
Pirate.
To make fun of the Max, so you know I have to fill that void.
So he's known for both being dirty and making fun of Max? It's just awesome. And once again, when I'm here to record, Imran is not. We have still never recorded an episode together, despite both being regular co-hosts.
For like 2 freaking months. But that's all right, because this episode has 3 times as many regular co-hosts as the last one.
Oh, true.
You're listening to Polycast, episode 80. I'm Lord Parkin, and I'm here with my fellow guest co-host, PyR8.
Hi, guys. How's it going?
Daniel Quick.
Am I really here?
Mark Alula.
Unlike Dan, I don't have an existence. I also can't say existence. Oh, forget it.
And the main thing.
And I'm back after completing my secret missions that prevented me from being present for the last 2 episodes.
Today in the research lab, we looked at a real tries and retreats.
Today on Forum Talk, we looked at some possible combinations of leaders and Civ for the unrestricted leaders option, how the AI tries to handle the endgame if the human player is about to win the space race, and some possible new ways of handling the economy in Civ.
And under the miscellaneous heading, Civ series complexity is increased upon a Civilization 5 a given.
Come on into the research lab, where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future.
Looking at these ideas for new traits, and I gotta say, I thought they were pretty bad.
Some of them are, and some of them aren't so bad.
Yeah. Like, most of them don't do anything at all until maybe halfway through the game.
Yeah, like with the diplomatic plus one relations, double speed of the United Nations and 25 fast missionaries, that's kind of not really a trait.
Yeah.
But I did have an idea that maybe instead of relatively useless stuff of getting the double speed on the United Nations one day, you could have a voting bonus, so you get a balance, but somewhere between 50 and 100% bonus in votes with the Apostolic Palace and United Nations, which could actually be an interesting game factor.
Yeah, especially if multiple nations add it. Like if you have 3 diplomatic nations that are, you know, relatively even sized and a couple of their guys, it would make the player want to suck up to them to get their diplomatic victory typically, or just vassal them, I suppose, get some cities, double the votes.
I think you'd have to be really careful doing that because it could potentially be very imbalanced, powerful. I don't know if any of you guys have played the Master of Orion games, but in those there's a similar victory condition where you can just get all the other players to vote for you as the winner. And if you're playing as the human race in that, it's incredibly easy to get people to vote for you, so that was how pretty much all the games ended, was the humans would win the diplomatic vote.
With the Apostolic Palace, you already get a 100% bonus in votes if you switch to religion, so
yeah.
I mean, an extra 50 or 100% on top of that is extreme. It'd be like the change 20 to 25 or 30 votes.
That thing's broken anyway. I'm sorry it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, rather than plus one relations, probably 2 or 3 would be more significant.
That's almost half of what you need to win Diplo victory vote, though. 3 would be. It's 3, because you need plus 8 as a net diplo, and that does include, well, your net diplo includes hidden modifiers you can't see, but basically you get the plus 8, then they'll vote for you to win as long as they don't like your opponent more. And very often it's easy to set up your opponent as somebody you don't like more. Especially if you're number one in top, you can just gift it to whoever and they'll build a thing for you.
But then again, if there are other diplomatic nations in the game, then they'd also be getting the same bonus, so it wouldn't simply leave them out. And I mean, like, you get just two different relations, minus two or something for warmonger versus peacemonger or something like that. So plus one seems a little too little.
I forgot about that. But yeah, this trait could also cause havoc if you increase it any more than plus one by altering the AI to AI relations. Anytime you start on a continent with two diplomatic guys and a warmonger, you're the target every game, pretty much, for example. Or, you might get into one of those religious or tech group hugs very easily because of the trait. So that would definitely add a different dynamic as well. Spying's pretty bad, too. I mean, for the majority of the game, you're getting plus 10 in espionage. That's worth what? Like, 0.4 espionage?
Yeah.
A couple extras after you have courthouses up.
I guess it could be useful if you were, using an entire spying economy right after Alphabet, but I don't think many people play that way, and it's really not that great.
You would pretty much have to gear your entire game towards taking advantage of that one trait.
Yeah.
Just to make it do anything.
And it still wouldn't hold up to, like, the other traits at all that are currently in the game.
Yeah, because in your normal game, the only amount of spy, if you're not doing the spy economy, the only spy points you get at the start are just from the palace, if I remember right.
In courthouses.
Yeah, but there's a long gap sometimes before you get courthouses built, so there's this huge part of the game where this trait is just...
Yeah, you'd have to build a great wall, settle your spine, start working from there, I guess.
Yeah. Maybe instead of the, or as well as the plus 10% espionage, you have, like, say, cheaper spy missions that could actually be interesting and useful.
Mm-hmm. And scary.
Now, if Scientific also gave you a discount on building the buildings that produce hammers, that might actually be pretty good.
I don't know. Right now, the way it's been proposed, monasteries...
Yeah.
You have four or five of those in the capital, and all of a sudden, you have a second Oxford.
The monasteries are a bit of a problem. If it wasn't applied to the monasteries, it could actually be reasonable. I mean, library, university,
laboratory,
giving 30%.
Yeah, it took to the classically scientific things and not the monasteries, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not a huge excessive amount.
A couple of monasteries aren't bad, though. You get in standard play, I mean, without the trait. They're about as good as an observatory in terms of their returns for their hammers, and they're available really early in the game. The only problem is it's hard to get enough of them without sacrificing things, but if you get a lot of religion spread to you automatically, they can be really useful in a bureaucracy capital.
Yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, each monastery given 15%, that means that you get basically three monasteries for the price of two.
Yeah, that would be wild.
Seems a bit obsessive.
I mean, I already love building monasteries if I have the Apostolic Palace religion, whether or not I've got the AP or not. But it just gives me another reason to build monasteries, even if that doesn't come about. So the suggestion now that this could apply to everything but monasteries, I'm sorry, I'm emotionally attached to the idea, and we cannot separate. If it's not attached to the monasteries, I don't want anything to do with this trade. It's garbage, right? All right.
Yeah. I think it would be interesting having it apply to everything.
The agricultural trait suggested here, unless you have some floodplains, boy oh boy, you know, plus one to all tiles producing four or more, and then I have to wait for grocers and supermarkets, which, depending upon what type of resources I've got anyway, that could end up being completely useless.
That's actually not too bad, because all of your grassland cows, all of your rice, all of your any of your grain resources, any seafood you have, all of that's going to take the food bonus. In some cities, it's going to be worth four food or more to you. Although it doesn't really make sense for an agricultural trait to improve your seafood count, but right now, as it's written, that it would. So you're talking several extra specialists, potentially, and off just the tiles you'd be working anyway.
Maybe we should call this the foodie trait.
I would call it the ultra-slavery trait.
Yeah. Having the extra growth that early in the game could actually be pretty strong. And I don't know how it would rate compared to the current traits, but it's definitely a lot more potent, for example, than spying or diplomatic.
Yeah, it could even have maybe something extra spiced up, like, say, the ability to spread irrigation from the start of the game or something early on rather than civil service.
Yeah.
And considering it's agricultural, maybe they could throw in a cheaper granary so you'd have something early in the game as well.
It's so strong, though.
Yeah.
And that's a big part of the reason Expansion is so good, is its cheap granary.
With the plus one food to all tiles producing four or more, I think it's good after biology.
Oh, jeez.
Holy crap, after biology.
Maybe a little bit too good.
I don't know. I mean, you've got your fully developed cottages by that stage. At the moment, it's sort of four food versus two food, maybe eight gold and a hammer if you're in universal suffrage. So boosting up to five food, that would make a really interesting decision, I think.
Well, if you do Kremlin Whipping, a five food grassland tile, it's just insane. And I know you don't want to loop too much whip anger, but still, if you needed to, it would be amazing. Or, like, if you're drafting in a globe theater city, it would be ridiculous.
Yeah. I suppose so. It really would make some testing.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jarnik suggested instead of plus one food for every tile producing four food or more, to give the plus one food to the city square, the square that the city is settled on, which, as he said, would be quite powerful at the start but become less significant as time progresses.
The difference between getting corn and rice is not really at all significant, I would have thought.
Maybe if it were plus two, though.
It would shave a few turns off the initial worker build.
Well, no different than settling on a plane, so.
Yeah.
I would take a trait that gave me plus two food on a city tile.
Plus two would be reasonable, yeah.
See, that would let you get away with settling some food-poor cities and still yield or some tiles.
Yeah, true, actually, that would be good to that.
Really speed up the opening enough where I would probably go for it. Especially over garbage like protective early in the game, or even aggressive.
Yeah.
The corporate trait suggestion, well, minus 50% maintenance cost to corporations and double production speed of Bank and Wall Street.
It's financial on steroids.
Well, I don't know. I don't think it's actually that great.
Yeah, it'll be good if you start in there, like with a Renaissance start.
Yeah, exactly. It's just too late in the game.
Yeah.
It'll do absolutely nothing for half of the game if you start from the ancient era. Absolutely nothing.
It'd be good if, like, corporations happened earlier in the game, maybe, but as it stands now, it's just not useful to have a trait that's going to reduce your corporation maintenance, so that's all it's going to do.
Obviously, any benefit that happens early in the game is much better than one that happens later in the game, just because of the snowball effect that you get. If you could have a trait that would just, like, start you with a worker at the beginning, that would be so powerful.
Like an immortal AI? Yeah.
Yeah. Even if it didn't do anything else for you the whole game.
Maybe the double production speed for executives or half the golden cost for sprint corporations, but I mean, still, that's late game, so it needs something in the early game to make it worthwhile, I think. I just thought of this. Maybe a corporate could have access to some of the economy civics, like mercantilism or something earlier, which could be interesting.
State property would be completely unbalancing, but mercantilism and free market could be reasonable early game.
Mercantilism is actually really powerful if you play in one of the later starts so that you can actually switch to mercantilism right at the beginning. It's incredibly good because you have, like,
absolutely
size four cities with a free specialist in each.
If you can get into representation with it, it's also decent from that standpoint as well.
Yeah.
The opening post had been revised several times before I got to it, because I guess at some point Draconian was even more overpowered than is currently being suggested.
Jeez, it's already... I haven't seen it other than this iteration, and it's already ridiculous.
I like
it. You need a trait to do that?
When I read this, the proposal was to allow drafting two units for the price of one.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's kind of a step away from double build speed for all military units.
Why don't you just turn on the world builder? Jeez.
But the slavery thing, it could be interesting. Maybe it would need to be nerfed slightly to maybe 35 hammers per citizen, but it could be an interesting trait.
Yeah. You wouldn't necessarily use a lot of slavery in every game, so it would vary from map to map, but I suppose that's true of some of the current traits as well. But drafting two units per turn is just, I don't know. Welcome to 60 rifles in 10 turns bearing down on the computer, or even another human computer. If it runs the Civic, it will draft. I was talking about this with the Better AI team. I suggested that the AIs use some offensive drafting. And J-Dog said that as far as that goes, if it's preparing for a war and it happens to be a nation voted, it does draft, and it'll draft defensively, too. The problem is that AI always just skips over nationhood and goes straight to free speech, typically, so we never see it.
Maybe instead of the two draft units per draft, you could have maybe reduced unhappiness, say two unhappiness rather than three per draft. That could be, well, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't either. The weird thing about the draft is, for a brief period in the game, it is the best, or one of the most efficient ways to produce units overall. And for most of the rest of the game, it's just moderate. For example, whipping infantry is better in some circumstances than draft, especially if you have the Kremlin. So it's kind of a weird tool. It's only good for a piece of the game. But when it is, it's really good.
I do like the idea of having a trait that influences a slavery in drafting, though, since both of those are such a potentially powerful tool in the game, and as it is, none of the traits directly affect them.
That's true.
You got the Aztec unique building, I guess, that provides a benefit for it, and that's the only civilization-specific thing.
The entertaining... I wanted to slam this one.
Yeah, I didn't actually understand what the hell that was about. It was saying, plus five culture for, on the slider for free, but can't have it over 100%. Does that mean once you get music, you can only have 95% tax or research? That sounds...
Yeah, that would be incredibly annoying if you're unable to set it to 100.
And then you had totally unnecessary complication of making the Colosseum had plus one per 15%. Why not just plus one per 10%? This is not exactly very powerful anyway.
This comment about this trait would work best if sliders can be set in increments of 5%. Wouldn't it be?
They can, actually. It's very easy to do it in the XML.
Yes, wouldn't it be required to have it set in an increment of 5%? Since you're saying you're getting plus 5% slider for free?
I took that to mean as just that the culture slider is automatically at 5%, even if you have like 100% science, say.
Oh.
Yeah, but he also said you can't have the total over 100%, so yeah, I'm not following.
I think he just means you can't have like 105% culture.
I would rather have diplomatic than this one, and that's saying a lot.
Yeah, it kind of seems like a wannabe charismatic trait, except much more like pointless.
You could sort of combine a lot of these traits into one, and it might end up being okay. If you had, like, the entertaining and the spying and the corporate.
Yes! Yes! Yes.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot SIV issues in the forums.
Leaders best combo question mark.
For peaceful games, I would probably favor Yautvang. Well, no, in general, if I'm playing single player, I would take Yautvang for every time because he can expand massively. He uses cheap granaries that give him culture, and if he starts near somebody who's problematic, he can just rush them right away. That's the unique unit for Inca. Also, he can completely ignore barbarians with his warriors. If you're playing single player, that's probably the way to go. It's so strong. You can fill out your land so quickly without any threat to you at all.
Yeah, that would definitely be the best option for this expansion.
And for a multiplayer, I would probably take Churchill of Mali. That's just obnoxious.
It is really obnoxious.
I tried this in GameSpy a couple times, which isn't the best barometer, but it's just funny to watch somebody try to deal with them. Especially if they're not, like, a great player.
Somebody attacks you with, like, 20 warriors trying to take out your fortified skirmisher on a hill.
They usually use archers, at least, but it doesn't matter, sure. Because a protective civ could take cover on the skirmishers. It's so advantaged attacking on flat ground, even. So you just run out pillaging all the tiles, and you sit on a hill near them. Or if the skirmishers take shock, they'll actually beat axes on flat ground.
Just everything about the skirmisher is just so obnoxious.
Yes.
I think Churchill of Native America is also a very popular pick to play games with unrestricted leaders. Because you have the super promotions, archers. Also, the charismatic trait works well with the totem pole.
My one gripe with that would be that they're not quite as strong on flat land, so you'd still be vulnerable to people choking or pillaging you.
Yeah, who cares? You got your city garrison three archers, cities.
No one would actually attack those, but they would probably make it so that you wouldn't do very well for the rest of the game anyway.
Yeah.
Napoleon of Mongolia would just be fun, but you know, I don't rate it as highly as the two I just mentioned.
Probably any charismatic leader would be good to have with Mongolia. I always thought it was weird that they didn't get one.
The reason I would favor organized is you're just trying to produce as many units as possible, and unlike with financial, you don't actually have to work a specific type of tile to get the bonuses, and you can whip in your courthouses and get Forbidden Palace up on that city across the map since you just captured half the world pretty quickly.
It'd be good to have either.
Absolutely.
I suppose, in case you rush, kill all the people around you and then actually have the traits to have a decent economy afterwards. Yeah, which is actually one of the reasons why, a lot of people probably disagree with me, but I think Boudicca Rome is a bit overrated.
I agree.
It's fun to play, but she doesn't have anything to help her out once she catches all that land. Obviously, she's won the game by then.
Plus, this still runs into the trouble that Rome frequently runs into, and that's needing iron. And she has no help if she doesn't get it. Whereas with some of the others we've mentioned, they are very strong, regardless of the situation. Although Boudicca Rome could be very strong, it's one-dimensional.
I think my top pick would have to be Regna Rome.
Same.
So you've got the aggressive trait for the Praetorians, and you also have the financial for being in the economy. So you're not going to lose unless you really try.
Or you get choked at the start of the game.
Yeah.
But that causes anyone to lose, really.
In the same vein of the Gaulian Kishiks, you could also have a charismatic leader with the war chariots, which would be fun. So, and Egypt or something like that. And one other, Brennus of Ethiopia, because he's got his spiritual and charismatic, so he can get the maximum leverage of switching back and forth to theocracy and vassalage, as well as getting the charismatic cheaper promotions, so you can get your crazily promoted RMO warriors then, and plus charismatic also works well with the steel.
Mm.
Oh yeah, I could see that.
You don't have a stupid created trait making it pointless.
This is Brennus of Egypt. You'd also have incentive to build your unique building, and charismatic would once again give quite a boost.
Some other suggestions in this thread for best unrestricted leader combo. Juana Capac of America, qualified as late game, but that's just me. What's the late game?
What's the modern era?
I don't know.
It's the one I don't bother to play because it lags my computer too much.
I'd take Juana Capac of Holy Rome over the America any day.
Yeah, I don't see the America thing, unless you're doing a late era start, but yeah. Even there.
For research, Elizabeth of Russia or France?
I don't really see the connection.
Elizabeth does have the financial trait, that's one good thing for her.
She's philosophical, too. I mean, if you want to go on a straight tech basis, she could tech very quickly. But I don't know if you'd want something as late as the Research Institute in a lot of games, as like your killer combo.
I've heard people talk about basing their game around getting the research center as quickly as possible in a Russia game. I've never done it, but it seems like it should be at least feasible.
I guess. I'd probably rather give her like something like Korea, though. She'll get a half off on her unique building.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the classical aura isn't bad with Korea.
Yeah, I could see that.
For maximum happiness, you could go for something like Hannibal of the Ottomans, so you've got the charismatic trait. Or you could go with Washington, because then you have both the healthy and happy traits.
That's true. You could skip monarchy a long time that way, especially if you get some resources.
And that's also going to give you a charismatic genocide.
Good point.
So even when you're getting steamrolled, you got a smile on your face. And, of course, the one leader we haven't talked about is Cid, and because that's just overpowered. That shouldn't be allowed.
Yeah.
Cid should be the philosophical, industrious guy. I would so pick that every time.
Yeah, I like how they made him the worst leader in the game.
Yeah.
No traits, leads the barbarians.
Two contrasting opinions on Space Race. In the first thread, Bath Maru, who was on episode 79, says that the AI doesn't try hard enough to win it, and Nothing As It Seems in the second thread said just got completely screwed by it. I can't actually think of a time I got completely screwed by the space race. Maybe that comes into the part about, again, the game is over before we get to that point.
Sounds like this guy definitely did get screwed.
It's been a while since I've seen a human player lose their capital to an AI in a space race game after launching. You just need to protect your capital for somewhere between 10 and 20 turns on normal speed, depending. Well, you 10 to 18, more like. Most people launch a more complete ship than that. But the point is, you don't have to protect yourself long. And not only that, if you have the text required for a spaceship, you have the text required for nukes, you have the text required for modern armor, and, you know, possibly even like infantry, although that's not really required, but a lot of people get it. Regardless, you have the means to protect yourself if you build any military at all, and with nukes, they shouldn't get anywhere near you.
It does sound like this guy was kind of taken by surprise. Somebody nuked him, and obviously most of his units would have died or become completely weak, and then they'd just come in and taken him. But he should have peered ahead and noticed where the units were coming from, and either attacked them if they were on the ground or sunk the ships if they were on the water. It shouldn't be that difficult if you've got to the end of the game. You obviously know a little bit about it.
That matter, you can figure out which AIs will even declare on you at all. If they don't declare on you, if their disposition is such that they have no declaration chance. For example, a lot of leaders don't declare it pleased. About half of them do. And the ones that do, you just need to be mindful of it. Check to see if they're going to declare or not, which can be seen in the Diplo screen with them. Or if you have bug mods, you can see it on the main screen. But if they have too much on their hands right now, it's time to be a little suspect as to who they're heading for.
Yeah, I think if they have too much on their hands, it doesn't matter how happy you make them, they'll still declare war if they were planning to declare war on you.
That's true. Once they make the war plans and they set a war target, then, I mean, the only thing that does stop them is kind of random, and it doesn't make sense. If the AI decides that it hasn't massed enough units, but it doesn't use your power at all in this consideration, if it doesn't make enough units in time, it can't. Four plans. You could delete all of your units and it would make no difference if you doubled up your units. This happened in one of Sisatil's games for the All Leader Challenge with Saladin. He was plotting war on Sisatil, and DNF5771 actually went in and tested that by deleting all of Sisatil's units, and still, Saladin left his war plans. Getting him to please or making him furious didn't matter.
Regarding what I think was like the main issue of this thread, I really don't think that the AI launched that attack just to stop him from winning the space race. I'm guessing that it was just bad luck.
It would have been, yeah, because the AI doesn't, I agree completely with the first poster, that the AI doesn't, there's no mechanism to make it want to attack you when you're about to win, which I think there actually should be. Maybe it just obviously, for the newer players, it would be a bit scary if suddenly everybody declares war on you and might be a bit unfair for Noble and below, and maybe one or two AIs make a half out of that effort to stop you. But once you get to Mortal and Deity, all hell will break loose once you launch the spaceship or something. That would make it really interesting.
They already have that piece of code in the game. I've seen it. It treats things differently if the AI thinks you're approaching a victory condition. Now, I don't think that's executed well currently. But the Civ programmers thought of that, and it's in the game. I've seen it mentioned in Better AI. It was existing code.
I know they refuse to trade you tech sometimes if that's part of your spaceship victory, but that's the only thing I've seen them do.
It has it read it out, and it calls it, "We'd rather win the game, thank you very much."
Yeah.
And as a side note, you know you're in trouble when you try to bribe an AI to peace, and it says that. That's not a good sign.
Yeah.
I think one of the things the poster in the second thread was complaining about was that the relationship between capturing the capital and the spaceship blowing up or whatever is a bit silly. And I agree that it's not really realistic, but there has to be some kind of mechanism to stop the spaceship and fire off, so the whole waiting 10 or 12 turns is pointless. And capturing the capital is decent. Well, I think somebody mentioned later on, I don't have the name here, that making it, capturing the Apollo program city would make it a little bit more sensible, so that could be something that could be changed.
Someone also pointed out that you can move your palace, sometimes even as the enemy's approaching.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, Mario, our spaceship is in another capital.
And if all else fails, you can just pre-build a few palaces around the map, and if your enemy is just a couple of turns from your capital, you can just shift it and play a game of hide-and-go-seek until you win. So there's really no excuse.
You could set up some sort of island fortress in, like, the South Pole.
Rush by.
Trying to hear.
Yeah, as the person who started this thread, you touched a nerve there, Philip, when you responded.
The doesn't try hard enough to win, or the...
They're completely screwed.
Oh, yeah.
Is you like, person in the opening post didn't get screwed by anything but poor diplo planning and or weak military. And he's like, yeah, so how do you protect your capital against a nuclear freaking bomb, bro? Oh!
Build SDI.
I answered him, too. I answered him.
Yeah, you did.
I've never had trouble AI nuking. Yeah, I've been nuked by the AI, but it just thinks its targets so poorly. It doesn't even seem to attempt to initiate stack attack with a nuke. It just nukes something. If it sees your stack, it'll nuke it, and that's pretty annoying. So if you're trying to raise their capital, it's a problem. But as far as like an actual all-out war, they're just horrible with nukes, even more so than they are usually in war.
I've actually never nuclear war with an AI. I'm either ahead of them and launching nukes on them by that stage, or the game's already over.
I had a pretty intense nuclear war with the AI one time. I think it started in the modern age, and it was a Pangaea map, so we were right next to each other. And basically, as soon as either of us sent a stack into their territory, it would get nuked instantly and couldn't really make any progress for a while.
I used them as recently as Lonely Hearts Club Zara, which is the current rendition of that series. The last two AIs I fought had access to nukes, and I had access to nukes. I was actually pretty far behind in tech, but just like them, I had vision and rocketry. And I had that flight thing we discussed a number of episodes back, where I just had a ton of fighters on carriers and a bunch of infantry. And I would just nuke a coastal city and take it then from the tech-leading AI, and it didn't matter that he had mech infantry or nukes of his own. I had a vassal on this continent, and he sent all his nukes to my vassal, which was very nice of my vassal, an even better version of the SDI for me. He just absorbed all the nukes, and I went on and swept some cities and took capitulation in like 6-7 turns. Nukes are definitely helpful there.
Yeah.
To tie something that you said a little earlier, Philip, in this topic, the thing about the AI just nukes something just for the purpose of nuking something and doesn't seem to have any particular strategy behind it.
Yeah.
Just nuke something. Your dinner plan or the AI's approach to nuclear warfare. And
there you go.
I suppose it could be and or.
Yeah. Try to eat the AI. Whatever works for you.
And so then I guess that takes us to the thread that's crying sacrilege.
What?
Who else hates the unholy trinity of hammers, coins, and food? says Lump Thing, I love Civ, but I find these aspects of its economic model very unsatisfying. Cities never export their food or building materials, and trade is a 90% a weird abstraction that just magically grows from the land. I prefer Sid Meier's colonization model. Food and building materials can be moved. Trade is based on the manufacture and exchange of goods. I was curious as to whether anyone else feels the same and is similarly afflicted with tantalizing visions of an entirely resource goods-based economic model. The thing about foods and building materials being moved around, I can see that, but the thing about trade is based on the manufacture and exchange of goods, oh.
Yeah.
I haven't played Colonization. It sounds like a lot of micro to me, though, and I don't like the sound of it.
Yeah, a simple design is sometimes just better. And a game spanning broad regions and times like so, at some stage you have to use a simplifying models or something to represent more detailed concepts to avoid like excessive complexity. For instance, you have like the general concept of the worker rather than unnecessary subcategories of miner, farmer, road builder, etc. And that just it wouldn't serve any purpose, really. And that's kind of how I feel with the whole trade thing. It doesn't add anything to the game. It just makes it more complicated unnecessarily.
Yeah, it's easy to add stuff to a game that might seem interesting at first, but after you play with it for a while, you realize it's just sort of annoying. Didn't they, in the first Civilization game, have a way to transfer food and building materials like this?
Caravans.
Caravan units, yeah.
Yeah.
I think they were in Civ 2 as well. I vaguely remember that. I didn't use them real well since I was young at the time.
Yeah, but think about all the stuff that goes into modern units and try imagining working out the logistics of getting everything there to build units if it was like colonization.
Yeah.
Your head explode.
Yeah.
I think the trade routes are quite fine how they are. Like, it's just a simple calculation that's worked out before you're in the background and you don't have to worry about moving all the units around. Although, I think the food and building materials, it could have a use. I mean, if it's just like shifting excess stuff between cities if you want to build something fast or have a particular city, I could see the use, but it does add extra complication to the game.
the food and building materials thing, that could be something that you could do for an added benefit, but it wouldn't be something that you would have to know how to do in order to be able to not get so completely frustrated with it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But with the trade thing, you can't avoid that, and it's just, oh, if I wanted to play a game, you know, where I was like, I don't know, an accountant, I could play that game.
You can play Master of Orion 3.
Yeah.
Yeah, you would have to be careful with moving building materials. Like, you would have to be capped, or you'd have to only be able to source one city or something. Is I'm just getting this picture right now of, like, rushing the Parthenon or some other culture-intensive wonder in a pop one city that's bordering an AI city, and then just destroying it with culture.
Oh, yeah. You got to have a limit. It's like on the airlifting units thing.
I mean, that's sort of limited, not really, in that case. I can also picture this being helpful. Like, you get one of those 3, 4, or 5 seafood starts, and before you can raise your caps, so a lot of that seafood goes to waste after you win, just because you're going to grow the cap otherwise. So if you could channel that into your other cities, grow them faster, you'd be able to whip more globally throughout your empire in a reasonable fashion.
Someone suggested for this person, Neokakadoam. Okay, your username is N.
I have allocated your name.
The thing about the trade, he says, he also thinks it's a good representation of average internal trade. The only thing I feel is deceiving is the way trade routes between cities are managed. They should be selectable by the player and put into emphasis in order to the player to actually take it into account. I would like to know more what you meant by they should be selectable by the player.
Who he wants to trade with? Like, in terms of cities?
Yeah, I think he's talking about that if you've got City A and then City B, you decide, okay, I want there to be a trade route between City A and City B for whatever reason. It sounds like an absolute. I don't think he means it as an absolute, but the way it's written, it is. Because there would have to be certain restrictions like we have right now with trade routes, needing to get certain technologies in order to be able to have trade routes existing between cities that you have, say, along the coast, for example.
That sounds like a necessary complication again, unless you mean it specifically to the resource transfer. If you're talking about just the commerce deals from trade routes, the game automatically maximizes that per city. Although I wouldn't mind doing away with that to some extent, because that accounts for a ton of the time between turns, just recalculating the trade routes every single time. That's annoying. But nevertheless, you do get the maximum trade route values possible under the current scheme.
Maybe you could have something go with that where if you choose another city as, like, the trade partner, you could help influence the culture of that city.
Get an espionage bonus, all kinds of nice complexities.
Yeah.
He also suggests the population should stop to grow with the amount of food there is in a granary. That should be more based on a fertility rate, based on several things like happiness, particular golden ages, baby boom after war, for example, and civics allowing to give some benefit to big families. The food should interact only with existing population.
Again, we have a question of scale here. You're considering a lot of very micro details in a game where, for much of the game, you have multiple years passing per turn.
Yeah.
I'd rather just go away from the entire trade concept than just have it as the calculations and concentrate on building my military units and moving them around. I don't really have to deal with any part of the trade thing.
And this is new username. He says, as to production, I feel it highly unrealistic. People do not build things out of the land. They are gathering resources out of the land, but do not build things out of it. Okay, I'm following you so far. Quote, therefore, hammers should be obtainable only with specialists. I always thought specialists were so optional, that would be an occasion to make them essential, unquote.
I could see that. I mean, I can see how it would make more sense from a realism standpoint. I don't know if it would actually be more fun that way.
Again, we're using these things that work tiles as representation of people working the tiles and building things, and specialists being even more specialized than that. And at some point, it would make working the tiles less useful. I mean, it would certainly change gameplay, but I don't necessarily think that would be for the better.
You can always snicker like some of the turns, like, what would you like to build in the city? A spearman. Well, nobody really builds a spearman. <You know? laughs> Then the end person says, maybe the return of shields that would exist, I think he means alongside hammers. Shields would be the resource gotten out of the land being worked, and hammers the effective specialized output of specialists that require food but can't work it. Oh.
Some people just can't let go of shields, can they?
Anything. Although I must admit, I've never seen someone saying, let's have hammers coexist with shields.
That's true. That's the first.
So you have the shields as the raw materials, and then you use specialists to turn those into finished products, I guess. Which
makes us close to colonization again.
Yeah.
Apparently people just like adding layers of complexity to the game, though, even though Civ 4 is more complex than any of the other iterations. Just want more.
It's almost certain, though, that Civ 5 will end up being more complex.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I don't think it'll be because of Civ Revolution, but like
pretty much every Civ release has been more complex than the one that was existing previously. But yeah, I don't see any reason that Revolution would cause a huge variation. Maybe a little bit simpler, but I don't think so. Civ already pushes its limit in terms of the Direct Civilization series and in terms of complexity. It's a hard learning curve for players already, so they could only go so far in that direction without losing some of their market audience. FireXis is well aware of its target market and won't lose too many people doing that if it can help it. There's a lot to learn before you can play Civ 4 at a high level, and, you know, actually a significant amount just to get to the noble range.
Yeah.
I had a friend like that who thought it was too complex to learn, but after I showed him how to rush with Praetorians, he was pretty much hooked.
I have to admit, I had a bit of a aversion to moving to Civ 4 right after it was released. I was one of the people that was not really too keen on having to relearn the whole game mechanics, but I mean, I was certainly glad that I did once I had gone, because Civ 4 has a lot more concept in it and a lot more in-depth and a lot more fun to play once you actually understand how it works.
Yeah.
Crashing your economy by doing it in the city sprawl. That's what I did my first game, I think.
See, I didn't play a lot of Civ 3, just a little bit. I mean, I guess I got up a region for a game or two before I stopped playing and got Civ 4. So my problem was similar to your typical Civ 4 newbie who hasn't played the earlier games in the series, where they underexpand instead of overexpand. Whereas the Civ 3 holdover seemed like they want to overexpand without minding commerce. I actually find it hard to overexpand on the highest levels now, just because you run out of space first.
Yeah.
Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY. You can Skype us at the Polycast.
Or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast, our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
For this show, this was Polycast session number 80. I'm Pyrite. The other people here are Lord Parkin.
Hello, and goodbye.
The Mian team.
I'll show you a blocking strategy.
Makalua? How do you say that?
Makalua.
Makalua, whatever.
Whatever.
He's carrying on the tradition of not pronouncing it right. Yay! And I'm carrying on the tradition of stumbling over any long words I try to pronounce.
Once it was noted that it was Makalua, then you added whatever at the end.
I'm changing your name, whether you like it or not. And the host, Dan Q.
This episode number is evenly divisible by 2.
That's like half of the other. Wow.
And also brought to you by the letters W and S. No, actually, the letters W, T, and F.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm still looking for the thread.
Whoa, hey, now this is a family-friendly show.
At least post-editing. That's one hot seat.
Record date?
October 17th, 2009.
Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright 2009, Civilized Communication at civcom.net.